I took notes on our election. Thought you'd want to know the results. I tabulated the winners and the losers. The first winner I tabulated down here was socialism, then abortion, then homosexual marriage. Obviously, it's not a laugh. Under the losers, I tabulated the military, military preparedness, and Israel in particular. The enemies of Israel are certainly going to gain strength. Our Constitution lost on this last election. And also, I believe, ultimately, religious freedom. I think there's a number of elements that are going to be reinforced and, you know, put forth and strengthened that are going to restrict our religious freedom as well. I love this nation, and I love and I am grateful for the blessings that have come down to us from Abraham because of his commitment and obedience to God. But it does appear to me that we're about to get a big dose of the fruit of the choices that so many people of our nation have made. Paul gave us warning to his own people in that time, but in Philippians chapter 2, verse number 12, he gave warning about a perverse and crooked generation in his day. You know, it's always been a perverse and crooked generation. We can look on the bright side. I think we need to look on the bright side. But we can't close our eyes to the reality of what takes place. The world was destroyed in a flood because the whole world had become crooked and perverse at that time. And so it is something that Satan has been able to reestablish, even when it was wiped out. The earth was cleansed before the flood, started out fresh, and Satan was able to reinstitute his program fairly soon afterwards. But Paul warned in his time, Philippians 2 and verse number 12, he said, "Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence," he says, "work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it's God who works in you both to will and to do his good pleasure." God is literally drawing us into obedience. But we have to respond. We have to set our will in response to that. "Do all things without murmuring or disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless." Harmless is interesting. I'm finding in my own heart as I watch the process that takes place before me in society that the part of me that's not harmless wants to keep asserting itself. It says to be harmless. "Children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world." The example that we set in the midst of these circumstances is dramatically important. And we have no idea in terms of to what exact degree God will use us in that way, but it is still important as God's calling in what he has given us. Jude 3, Jude only being one chapter, so Jude verse 3, portrays a series of perverse and crooked generations and what God's response to them was over a period of time, recorded at least biblically over thousands of years. But Jude, starting in verse number 3. It says, "Beloved, while I was very diligent to write to you concerning our common salvation, I found it necessary to write to you, exhorting you to contend earnestly for the faith." Brethren, I think we're already contending earnestly for the faith. I think it will get worse. At some point, the church becomes persecuted in the end. At some point. We're not there yet, but it has to start by degree. A loss of rights, a loss of freedom, a loss of privileges, and eventually direct persecution because it will be tolerated. In fact, it will be promoted. So, Jude here, writing, he says, "Contend earnestly for the faith which was once and for all delivered to the saints." So be ready to fight for what you believe harmlessly. Not running out as others do and, you know, taking the law into our hands or in some way in militant fashion. But it says, be ready to contend spiritually. Down in verse number 5. It starts to give examples of different perverse generations, God's response. I want to remind you, though you once knew this, that the Lord, having saved the people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe. They came out of sin, all of them, by analogy at least, and yet those who did not continue on, God turned and destroyed. The angels who did not keep their proper domain, but left their own habitation, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day. Sodom and Gomorrah, and the cities around them in a similar manner to these, having given themselves over to sexual immorality, gone after strange flesh, are set forth as an example suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. Verse number 8 goes back and reflects on that series, because it says, likewise, these dreamers defile the flesh, Sodom and Gomorrah. They reject authority, the angels who rebelled. And it says, and speak evil of dignitaries, going all the way back to Israel. There was always complaining, murmuring, accusing those who were leading them, bringing themselves into rebellion. Going on to illustrate the importance of respectful manner and proper words, verse 9 says, yet Michael the archangel, in contending with the devil, when he disputed about the body of Moses, dared not bring against him a reviling accusation, but said, the Lord rebuke you. He did not even take it on himself to condemn or to confront Satan. He used God's authority and said, the Lord rebuke you in that way. These speak evil of whatever they do not know, and whatever they know naturally, like brute beasts in these things, they corrupt themselves. Now, it's interesting, verse number 11, because there's a phrase in here that we're familiar with, but I'm not sure to what degree we may have actually studied it out. Woe to them, they have gone in the way of Cain. They have run greedily in the air of Balaam for profit. They have perished in the rebellion of Korah. Again, giving different examples of different generations and various faults and failures that took place. Well, Korah's easy. It says rebellion of Korah. Balaam is easy. It says greed for profit. He was willing to teach a lie in order to take a bribe in order to be enriched. Compromise for enrichment. What is the way of Cain? Balaam's clear, Korah's clear, the other three are explained previously in the examples that were given. What is the way of Cain? The word way in Greek can mean road or direction. Well, he went that way, went down that road. But the way it is used in that sense, in a religious sense, broadens it to a system of doctrine or instruction. Acts 18 is an example of this. And we ought to look at Acts 18 when we're looking in terms of what does it mean, the way of Cain. The way of Cain is the way of this world. It is the way of the God of this world. And it has been established and reasserted again and again over time. And that is what the book of Jude ultimately is addressing. But Acts 18 and verse number 24 says, a certain Jew named Apollos, born in Alexandria, an eloquent man, mighty in the scriptures. So we're talking about the importance of this example in reference to being able to speak the truth, God's word, by using his scripture as illustration. Came to Ephesus. The man had been instructed in the way of the Lord. This doesn't just mean you turn left or you turn right. This is a body of belief. It's a way of life, the way of the Lord. Being fervent in spirit, he spoke and taught accurately the things of the Lord, though he knew only the baptism of John. So he began to speak boldly in the synagogue. And when Aquila and Priscilla heard him, they took him aside and explained to him the way of God more accurately. This broad system of understanding, not just that Jesus died and rose from the dead, but all of the implications that go with it, so that he could go out and teach the scripture as a light to the world. And when he desired to cross to Achaia, the brethren wrote, exhorting the disciples to receive him. And when he arrived, he greatly helped those who had believed through grace. He vigorously refuted the Jews publicly, showing from the scriptures that Jesus is the Christ. The word way here is an entire system of doctrine and instruction. It is what God has given us. It is how we are supposed to live. In the book of Jude, the way of Cain is like that. It's not just one choice. It's not a moment in time. It's a whole system. It is the system of the God of this world. The way of Cain is where Satan's system in this world begins. Now, obviously, it begins with the choice of Adam and Eve at the tree, but it has to be dispensed somewhere. It has to be taken in somewhere and developed and put to use. And we see that most fully in the example of Cain. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 4. Genesis chapter 4, starting verse number 1. So I want to walk through the example here with Cain and his life, the descendants of Cain, and again, the system that he established, which then had to be reestablished and has continued down to our day. And we stand in the midst of a wicked and perverse generation as lights in the midst of the way of Cain. It says, Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, who was the firstborn child of Adam and Eve. It was Cain. Who should ultimately that promise have gone through to carry the mantle of the teaching that they had received, the firstborn child. And I have gotten a man from the Lord. Now, it's interesting. The word I have gotten here is a reference. Eve is saying, look, I did this. This is mine. And even in the Hebrew, one of the words there is more, I have gotten a man, the Lord. So Eve is actually saying, this is mine. God did, made creation, and now I have made creation. But that ought to give just a little bit of a hint in terms of where this whole matter is headed. Genesis 4, going on. Then she bore again, and this time his brother Abel. Abel was a keeper of the sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And in process of time it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of their fat. The Lord respected Abel and his offering, which says more than the fact that maybe Abel brought a good thing, a $10 item, and Cain brought a bad thing, a 20-cent item. Therefore, God liked the one and not the other. That isn't the only point. Yes, Abel gave of the firstlings, the best. The first was given to God, not the leftovers. I think that's part of the point. But it says he respected Abel and his attitude and his approach. He did not respect Cain and his offering. So not only was the offering not acceptable, it wasn't the firstlings, but it was the way, it was the attitude, it was the way of Cain that came associated with it. And Cain was very angry and his countenance fell. So the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? Why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. God warns him about letting this way that had begun to seep into his mind from taking control. Cain talked with Abel, his brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose against Abel, his brother, and killed him. We're not talking a moment of passion. We're talking premeditated murder. We're talking the strongest way in which a person could plan and carry out their desires. Then the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel, your brother? And he said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? He said, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So now you are cursed from the earth, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. A fugitive and a vagabond you will be on the earth. And Cain said to the Lord, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Surely you have driven me out this day from the face of the ground. I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and vagabond on the earth, and it will happen that anyone who finds me will kill me. And the Lord said to him, therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord set a mark on Cain, lest anyone finding him should kill him. If you're wanting me to tell you exactly what the mark was that was on Cain, I cannot, because the Bible doesn't specifically lay it out. And I'm simply not going to go and insert the blank and define it as such. The fact is, God, in some way, made it evident and obvious that Cain was not to be killed. You know, it's interesting, when Satan rebelled against God, the prophecy shows that he'll eventually be cast into Tartaru, or a condition of restraint for the angels. Well, why didn't God just put him in there right away? Why didn't he save me all the trouble of my life and you of yours and just get him out of the picture now? Because it wasn't God's plan. What is the penalty in the Bible for taking a man's life in murder? Death. If you pick up a stone and you hit somebody with that stone so that they die, that's murder. It's not accident, the fact that you had a stone in your hand, because it implies intent. If you had no intent, you wouldn't have had the stone in your hand. You would have simply become angry and maybe had some disagreement. And so the penalty for death, as it was portrayed biblically a little bit later in the text, was death. But Cain was not killed in this respect. He was allowed to continue on. He was allowed to insert Satan working through him, his way into society, so that those who would follow would have to make that choice, so that they would live in the midst of a wicked and perverse generation and have to shine as lights to the world. It's not enough, as I've said, to choose to obey God. You have to choose not to sin. You have to make both choices. All the angels chose to obey God until Satan sinned. They only had chosen one direction. Once Satan sinned, there was now two directions of choosing. Choose yes to obey, no, not to disobey. And frankly, it is presented to the first fruits in the most desirable and enticing manner. The first fruits have a higher calling. We are called to God at a time that is indeed more difficult than what will be for the rest. Now, there are a few scriptures that illustrate what some of the problem was in regard to the offering and the attitude of Cain as well. And one is Hebrews 11 and verse number 4. Hebrews 11. The faith chapter. Abel's offering was offered in faith. By faith, Hebrews 11, 4. Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain. In other words, he had to believe, he had to actually have a certain amount of, he had to be out there a bit by faith. To have your faith tested means it isn't all going to work out okay by sight. So there was an element of sacrifice to what Abel did that was different than what Cain had done. He offered a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and through it, he being dead, still speaks. What you have, Cain and Abel, are typical of two different systems. There is the system of God, referenced in the Bible as the sons of God, and there is the system of Satan, referenced in the Bible as the sons of men. There were two family lines that left from the time of the children of Adam and Eve, and one became part of Satan's system in a fundamental way, and the other was where the line of righteous servants continued to follow. How important do you think it is for the example that we set for our children? How important is it for the words that we say and what we teach them, that our children are a heritage, that they're given to us for a time, and we take and actually work with our children so that we can hand them back to God? It is the most important thing that we can ever imagine. And the Bible shows that there are two family lines that came out of Adam and Eve and their family. One was a God-fearing line of which righteous individuals were able to be called. They were able to become righteous because of their calling. And the other was a line of individuals that continually chose to do evil. It is an amazing process, but it is recorded here. 1 John 3 and verse number 10. Excuse me, I've got to go over another book here. 1 John 3, verse number 10. Says, in this, the children of God and the children of the devil are manifest. What's the word manifest mean? Well, manifest destiny. is the obvious destiny of our people as it was seen at that time. So manifest means to be made known. It says, in this, the children of God, those who can be righteous or will be responsive to God, and the children of the devil, those who go the way of this world, are made known. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is he who does not love his brother. It goes right back to Cain and Abel. It says, for this is the message that you heard from the beginning, that you should have love, or that you should love one another. Not as Cain, who was of the wicked one. See, Cain was of the wicked one. The way of Cain means serving Satan. And he murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his works were evil, which means not from that moment only forward, which means that's where he had already placed himself. His works were evil, his brothers were righteous. You know, I guess that's what brings persecution on, is when an evil person has power over a righteous person and they have opportunity to assert themselves. Watch what happens over our next years and see if religious liberty in this nation is not reduced. Watch and see if it does not begin to play out in various ways. Cain was of the wicked one. He went Satan's way. Proverbs 16 and verse 25 talks about that way. Again, more than just a left or a right or a direction, but a very specific reference to that way of life. Proverbs 16, verse number 25. There is a way that seems right to a man, Satan's ways, but it's the way of death. Because in the end, there bears nothing but evil fruit. I want to go through some of the family line of Cain, show you the fruit of what came out of him following Satan, because his children learned to follow Satan, and his children's children's children learned to follow Satan as well. And the example is laid out for us very, very specifically. As I've said, the children of cannibals are what? Cannibals. Okay? The children of hypocrites, too often, too easily, are hypocrites as well. Genesis 4 and verse number 16. Going back to the record. It says, Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod in the east of Eden. Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch. Now, this is not the righteous Enoch, the Enoch who walked with God. That's from Seth's line. Seth is the one that God had given back to Adam and Eve so that the lineage of a righteous line could continue because Abel had been killed. The Enoch who walked with God was from Seth. She bore Enoch, and he built a city, and the name of the city, he named it after his son Enoch. Going on, verse 19, it says, Lamech took for himself two wives. Now, this is part of the family line. You go through verse 18, and it names families, and then Lamech came along. Who was the first bigamist? Who was the first person to take two wives? It was Lamech. What family line? Well, it was the family line of Cain that first took two wives. You know, Genesis 2:24 says, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. They shall become one flesh. So God's intent was that two were to become one, not three would become one. Three cannot become one. It is not how God designed it. The fact that others later, even some who were righteous, took extra wives was never God's ultimate intent. He would have worked it out, but he allowed it to be so. Just as divorce. He said, I never intended for you to have divorces. It was the hardness of your heart. Abraham worshipped the groves on the hills, and God had to at one point tell him, let's not do that anymore. He had to constantly bring his people back, and he had to constantly restore his people to the knowledge of the truth. Israel lost the knowledge of God, the Sabbath. They had to restore that. The holy days all had to be returned back and restored again and again and again. The time of the judges goes through and portrays that very, very clearly. So Lamech of the line of Cain was the first bigamist and set that pattern in the stage to come. Genesis 4, verse number 20. It says, Ada bore Jabal. Jabal was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. Well, that's nice, you know, kind of pastoral. His brother's name was Jubal, and he was the father of those who play the harp and the flute. So one's out there with the herds, the other one's playing music, the herds are relaxed, you know, they're happy cows from California like the ads are eating their grass. That's not the point. It says those who play the harp and the flute. The word play in the Hebrew means to seize, to take hold of forcibly. You know, it would be so nice to have a Bible that actually had these things portrayed the way God wrote them and not always have to dig in to find what is there. So much of what is in the Bible is just papered over in the process of the translation. It is indeed a shame. Play in the Hebrew means to take hold of or seize with force, to misuse that in some way. We're talking about taking music and using it in a way that is an ungodly manner. So, again, from the line of what? Well, from the line of Cain. If you look at Proverbs 30, this very same word that says play, I want to show you how it's used in another illustration. Proverbs 30 and verse number 7. Okay, verse number 7. It says, two things I request of you, deprive me not before I die. Remove falsehood and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food you prescribed for me. Lest I be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and take, effectively, the name of the Lord my God in vain. Profane the name of my God. The word profane here is the same word play, which effectively means to take hold of and misuse. So profane here, ultimately, the King James Version says take. It's the same word, profane. It shows you the context of Genesis 4 and verse 21. In the book of Jeremiah 2 and verse number 8, we have the same word used again. I want to reinforce what happened in the family line and the impact that it had, because some of it, frankly, is just not as obvious in Scripture as it should be. Jeremiah 2 and verse number 8 gives reference to the fact of the priests who were not being faithful to God. And it has this same word, the Hebrew word, that would be translated take in other places. But it says the priests did not say, where is the Lord? And those who handle the law did not know me. Handle means to handle it in a forcible or in an improper way, to misuse it. Same word. Same word play in Genesis 4. Same word that would be take. So he says, they handle the law and they do not know me. They did not know me. So again, that goes back and gives a little more context. But again, Genesis 4. Go back to the original account. Because this plays out in significant fashion. Genesis 4 and verse number 22. As for Zillah, she also bore Tubal-Cain, an instructor of every craftsman in bronze and iron. Okay, he's got his little roadside stand on the side of the highway, and the tourists stop, and they buy these trinkets from him, and he has very nice things. He's an instructor of every craftsman in bronze and iron. A little later, I want to portray to you some of the Greek perspective of the history of the Bible to show you how it overlays. And they portray the line here of Cain in Greek mythology as an individual with a double-bladed axe and a warrior that releases Athena so that she can be born and become worshipped. Now, again, I can't go too deep into that because I'm not that bright. But I will go a little bit deep into it to show you. But again, this is not just somebody working with metals. You can use bronze and iron for agricultural purposes, I'm sure. You can plow up the fields, and there's implements that you're going to need. But what are the main uses for bronze and iron, frankly, going back to these days? War. It's the use for war. And the history shows that the reference here as well is to war and the utility of war and the using of these instruments and implements in that way. Genesis 4:25. In fact, I need to go back up here. I didn't finish on this. Okay, verse 23. And this again is in this very context of these implements being used and utilized and made available. Ada and Zillah, hear my voice, O wives of Lamech. Listen to my speech. I have killed a man for wounding me, even a young man for hurting me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. In the very context of the bronze and the iron and being able to craft it, Lamech has killed someone. Now again, all the details are not laid out, and all the story flow is not here. But the context follows. This is a story about the line of Cain and how they began to have evil intent and they misused and misapplied the things that they were able to produce and accomplish and create and the consequences that came as a result. When you then trace the descendants of the family line and you begin to see the names pop up, what you see is enemies of God's people, enemies of Israel over and over again. It says, Adam knew his wife again. She bore a son, named him Seth, for God has appointed another seed for me instead of Abel, whom Cain killed. As for Seth, to him also a son was born. He named his name Enosh, and the men began to call on the name of the Lord. There was a family line that came out of Seth that directed people back to God, and they began to call in the name of the Lord. They began to look back to God and follow in his ways. Again, flowing through the context, comparing it to the line of Cain. Genesis 6. This is a context about sons of God, daughters of men. There are those people who believe that the angels came down, picked up a few cuties, had sex, had babies, had half-demon babies that were able to go out and be great warriors on the earth. They believe that. They do not know the scriptures. Genesis 6. Came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. Now remember, we were just back here showing that the men along the line of Seth began to call on God, to take God's name in that sense. The Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. Going to come up now to the flood and the destruction of the human race, except for those God would save. There were giants on the earth in those days. It doesn't say that the union of the men and the women described was the giants. It just says there were giants on the earth in those days, in those days when these things were happening. There were giants before the flood. There were giants after the flood. Goliath was about 9 feet or maybe a little more tall. He was huge, and he lived, obviously, in the time when David was able to kill him. And also afterwards, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. These, the giants, were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, a wicked and perverse generation, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he made man on the earth, and that he was grieved in his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing, birds of the air. I'm sorry that I've made them. How this has turned out, the way this has played. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. I want to read you from the Bible reading program. The program has not been continued at this time. I'm not sure when they will continue. I'll just say what was done I thought was incredibly helpful to me. But in Genesis 6, some commentary I would like to read to you. It says, some have taught that Genesis 6 describes fallen angels interbreeding with human women to produce half-demon giants. There is a more rational explanation. It says, angels are spirit beings, not fleshly creatures. They neither marry nor sexually reproduce. Obviously, it's listing the scriptures that support that. In Genesis 1, each kind reproduces only according to its kind. Jesus explained that fallen angels or demons are not able to manifest themselves materially like he and the righteous angels can. Rather, we see demons in Scripture only possessing individuals or appearing as ghostly apparitions. And so they're obviously not going to appear in a physical form the way an angel, a righteous angel, would. Genesis 4 gives the story of Cain and Abel and follows with the genealogical descent from Cain. Genesis 5 is called the book of the genealogy of Adam. It starts with God's creation of Adam and how Adam's line continued down through Seth. We have these two lines and the history of each one being contrasted one to the other. As with the angels, Adam was a son of God by creation, even though more so since Adam was made in God's image. Of this family line through Seth, it is stated, these men began to call on the name of the Lord, which could also be rendered call after the name of the Lord. Then in the next chapter, Genesis 6, we see the sons of God, men of Seth's godly line in this explanation, intermarrying with the daughters of men, women of Cain's ungodly line. They were taking for themselves wives from a line of people that were not obedient to God, who were teaching and promoting and living a way that was the way of Satan. In any event, human beings are clearly the problem here, not angels. The giants mentioned must have been human too. Descendants of Adam and Eve, these very tall people were destroyed in the flood. But there would be more of them following the flood, who were descended, just like everyone else in the post-flood world, from Noah. Consider Goliath, whom David slew. He was more than 9 feet tall, but he was still just a man. Now, Genesis 7 and 8 is the story of Noah and the flood. Noah was what of what family line? The line of Seth. The line of Cain apparently was wiped out in the flood, and I say apparently, because Noah, his genealogy was perfect in that sense. He traced back through that godly line. He traced back through a line of faithful individuals. I couldn't say that every person in the line had been faithful, but those who God was calling came out of the line of Seth. But his children had to marry, and my guess would be that it was Ham's wife who was probably of the line of Cain. That's not scripture. I can't prove it. I'm only saying Ham was able to carry on with his family, and what we see is the way of Cain being reestablished after the flood. Those who were of his family line were wiped out in the flood, but it was fairly quickly reestablished, and I can show you that. Genesis chapter 9 and verse number 18. It says, the sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. Who were the Canaanites? Canaanites were the people in the land that Israel was promised that were going to be ejected when their sins, it also mentioned the Amorites, when their sins are full, have come to fullness, then I will eject them from the land. Were the Canaanites friends and allies of Israel? No, they were people that had to be expelled. And so we see again in the family line here, as it's referenced, verse 18, father of Canaan. These three were sons of Noah, but from these the whole earth was populated. Noah began to be a farmer. He planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine and was drunk and became uncovered in his tent. It's not saying he got so drunk he threw his clothes off like the Western song sings. It's saying that he became uncovered. Somebody uncovered him. Somebody abused him when he was drunk. And the story follows. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on their shoulders, went backward, covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away, and they did not see their father's nakedness. Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done to him. Now, his younger son, you would stop and think in terms of that's Ham. But if you look at verse 23 as being parenthetical and read from verse 22, it would say, Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. So Noah awoke from the wine and knew what Ham's younger son had done to him, to Noah. Again, I'll read you some comments from the Bible program. And he said, cursed be Canaan. If Ham had done something, he would have cursed Ham. It was Canaan who did something, and it was Canaan who was cursed. And it was his specific line as well. A servant of servants he shall be to his brethren. He said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. May Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and may he dwell in the tents of Shem. and may Canaan be his servant. And Noah lived after the flood 350 years. So all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Again, I want to go back to the Bible reading program in response to this. And under Genesis 9, it says, some decades after the flood, time enough for Noah's sons and to father their own sons and for these children, grandchildren, to grow up, Noah became a husbandman, growing grapes and making wine. Then, when he drank the wine, he became intoxicated, fell asleep in his tent, whereupon the Bible records his nakedness was uncovered. This expression is used throughout Leviticus 18 to denote sexual relations. When Noah's son Ham discovered him, he told his brothers, who then covered their father. When Noah awoke, he learned of what happened and called forth a curse on Ham's youngest son Canaan. Why? Why should Canaan be cursed? Verse 24 states that Noah knew what his younger son had done to him. This is often interpreted to mean that Noah knew what Noah's younger son Ham had done to him. Yet if Ham himself were guilty of whatever wrong had been committed, he would assume that Noah would have cursed him personally. Or his offspring were to be cursed, that it would apply to all his offspring, perhaps the eldest and his family, rather than just his youngest son, Canaan, and those who would spring from him. The most likely scenario is that Canaan himself had committed the wrong. Apparently some sexual sin against Noah while Noah was intoxicated, which Ham then discovered. Thus, verse 24 should probably be understood to read that Noah knew what his, Ham's, younger son, Canaan, had done to him, particularly if we consider verse 23 as parenthetical. Again, look at the trouble that ensues and continues and perpetuates itself down a family line as the founder of that line turned and went the way of the God of this world, and the consequence that continually reasserted itself. Genesis 10. This is the genealogy of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and sons were born to them after the flood. Now, I only want to brush through a little bit of this because, honestly, I haven't studied out all the names. I don't know where all they went, but there's some of these names stand out as rather familiar. It says, verse number 6, it says, one of the sons of Ham was Canaan. Well, we know that, but it's in the genealogy. And again, Canaan ended up being an enemy people to Israel. If you go down to verse number 8, it mentions in verse number 6 Cush as well, ties that in verse number 8. Cush begat Nimrod. Nimrod came from that same line now of Ham. Nimrod was an enemy, founded Babylon, founded Nineveh, Assyria, as the record follows. He began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Verse 11, from that land he went to Assyria, and he built Nineveh. When you look at the great image of Daniel 2, you have Babylon, you have the bronze, you have the silver, you have the gold, the silver, the bronze, and the iron. And you follow down through empires that were enemy empires to God's people and to God. And at the very base of that image was the stone, Jesus Christ, smashed. And notice the way the world looks at the value. You go from gold to silver to bronze to iron. Stone would be lower than that, and yet it is the stone that smashes the image at the base and topples and crushes it that turns into a kingdom and fills the earth. So Nimrod is fundamental to establishing the entire system, reestablishing the way of Cain, again, as it is recorded here. Verse 14, it goes on, it mentions Keluhim, from whom came the Philistines. Where are the Philistines today? Today. Where are they? Where are the descendants of the Philistine people? In Gaza. That's where the area of those people reside. Is that a friend to Israel? Were the Philistines ever a friend to Israel? Did the Philistines ever make peace with Israel or let them be? The prophecy here just shows that Philistines come from that same family line as well. Verse number 16 talks about the Amorites. Well, let's see. It was the Amorites who had to be cast out of the land along with Canaan when their sins became full and God could tolerate them no more. Again, no friend of Israel. Verse number 19 talks about the borders of the Canaanites and the families that were related to them, and it begins to describe the territory. And it says the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon, as you go toward Gerar, down the coast, as far as Gaza, okay, as far as the Philistines. And then you go toward Sodom and Gomorrah, so now we go over to Sodom and Gomorrah, illustrations that were mentioned in Jude as well. And it just goes on and shows where all the boundaries of these people were, and the people and the evil that existed in their midst. That was indeed the way of Cain. I want to go back to Daniel 2, not back to, go to Daniel 2, because that's where the image is described, and I want to at least read it in a more direct manner. Daniel 2, verse 31. This is Satan's system. This is how it is portrayed. This is what has to be destroyed. This is what we live in the end of, the finish of, the base of in the end time. But it came down to us by way of Cain, reestablished by Nimrod, recorded in the mythology of the Greeks. And again, I'll illustrate at least a bit of that. Daniel 2 and verse number 31. You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, feet partly of iron and partly of clay. And you watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, clay, bronze, silver, and gold were crushed together, became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Paul said, hold on. Hang in there. Be a light in the midst of all these troubles and evils around us. I believe the troubles and evils are going to increase. I believe religious freedom and opportunity is going to decrease. I guess prophetically I could stand by that very clearly. I think specifically we're seeing it begin to play out in a more dramatic way. I've had a chance to finally do a little bit of reading in the Parthenon Code, a book that I've had on my shelf for a period of time, and simply haven't got to the point where I could bring that up to the top of the stack and begin to go through it. It talks about the center of the Greek Empire was obviously Greece. And the center of Greece was Athens. And the center of Athens was the Acropolis. And the center of the Acropolis was the Parthenon. The Parthenon is the marble structure with the columns around the side that is so famous and so well known by sight. And the center of the Parthenon was Athena. The statue of Athena that was worshipped inside the Parthenon that was there. Now, unfortunately, I'll read you a little bit of what's in the book. I don't mean to portray that whatever is here must be true, but there's enough here that I believe is accurate because it's consistent with what has taken place in cultures around the world. But I want to read you at least a little bit of what it states. Ancient Greek religion, which we call mythology, tells the same story as the book of Genesis, except from the point of view that the serpent is the enlightener of mankind rather than the deceiver. Greek mythology is Satan's record of Bible events, portrayed down to his empire, part of the image, the great image that will have to be destroyed. Zeus and Hera, the husband and wife, brother-sister pair, are pictures of Adam and Eve. Athena represent Eve as well, except that Athena is the reborn Eve, effectively after the flood, the reestablishment of Satan's system, the way of Cain. She and the Parthenon and the entire ancient Greek religious system celebrate the rejuvenation and reestablishment of the way of Cain after the flood. Though on one hand, Greek idol worship contradicts the teaching of the Word of God, on the other, if properly understood, it reinforces the truth of the Scriptures. So I'm not going to prove it to you out of the Greek mythology, and proved it to you out of the Bible, but I want to use this as an illustration in support of that. In page 185 of the text, there's another statement that's made, which again makes a little bit of sense out of why the gods, small g of the Greeks, acted in the manner that they did. Page 185. It says, Adam and Eve are the first couple according to Genesis. Zeus and Hera are the first couple according to the Greek myth. Zeus and Hera's qualities are very, very human. They get angry and resentful. They drink, eat, and party. They become jealous and even furious at times. They make love, and Zeus in particular lusts and is unfaithful. In the Greek world, Zeus and Hera are historically and archetypically united as if they were a human pair. The reason for this is obvious. They were actually a human pair. They're a type, a mythology based on the Bible events. They are the original human couple, Adam and Eve, immortalized as the father and mother of all humanity. Understanding this elemental truth of Greek religion, we can say with Paul, of that race we are also. Zeus and Hera are Greek images of our ancestors, Adam and Eve. Now, it wasn't suiting to my purpose to go through and to try to do a sermon on Greek mythology. I did give a sermon after a lecture that Gail and I went to on the failure of philosophy, which traced the roots of Western civilization to Greece, not to Rome, to Greece, to Greek philosophers, traced the roots of evolution to Greek philosophers, to show how that system has come down to our time, part of that great image that must be destroyed. I gave a sermon once a few years back as well on mystery Babylon the Great, showing how the Babylonian system, once established, has carried on down to our day. And those are obviously available in the library, even though it's going back a few years. What is interesting, when you begin to look at the Greek gods, again, small g, you have one who is Nereus. He is a half-fish. They call him the Wet One. And they portray him on the vases and the cups and the paintings and drawings of which there are numerous depictions going back into 500 B.C. or so. But they show him as Nereus, portraying Noah, the one who came through the flood. They have the god Canis, portraying Cain. They have Hercules. Now that's interesting. We're all familiar with Hercules. That's actually the Roman name. The Greek is spelled slightly different. Who do you think Hercules portrays? Who would Hercules, who in the Bible was strong and a great warrior and went out and did great conquests? Nimrod. Hercules is Nimrod. What did Nimrod do in Greek mythology? He had 12 labors he had to accomplish. You know what the last and greatest labor, and you went all through the symbolism. I mean, there's so much symbolism that it's amazing. It goes beyond my ability to even study it out, maybe beyond what I would even need. But his final labor was to find the hidden garden of the Hesperides. The Garden of the Hesperides is portrayed in here, not because somebody just made it up, because they have pictures of this that have been drawn on vases, and it's a group of ladies standing around an apple tree with a snake coiled around its base. The Garden of the Hesperides was hidden and have to be found so that the golden apples could be retrieved and returned to Athena. Yeah, I mean, excuse me, I don't think it's a coincidence. You know what the image is for Zeus when he is shown in animal form? A snake with a beard. An old, ancient snake. The statue of Athena in the temple that was reproduced as well, and they have a copy at least of what they portray it in, I think, in Tennessee in a museum that is there. But it shows, again, the depiction of it in the book because they've taken this from various pottery and paintings and portrayals over all of those ancient years, is a snake at the side of Athena, and it is upright and standing. Many of the snakes in the pictures are upright and standing. There are snakes throughout much of this. Greek mythology is Satan's depiction of the story of the world according to the line of Cain. And it plays out over and over and over again. It is an incredibly fascinating story, even if it is indeed a lie. You know, Islam made up a story that Ishmael was the favored son. And all the Bible came to be seen in that light. Satan is a liar. He's the father of lies. And he's a thief. And he would steal from us our knowledge and convictions if he could. 2 Timothy 4. Going back. 2 Timothy 4, verse number 1. When Paul is charging Timothy the importance of preaching the word, the way of God, God's words, to always be ready to preach in the word, be ready in season, out of season, convince, rebuke, exhort with all long-suffering and teaching, because we live in the middle of a wicked and perverse society, a wicked and perverse generation. And it has always been that way. That will not change until that stone smashes the base of that image and the kingdom of God is established. The time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine. But according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they'll heap up for themselves teachers, and they'll turn their ears away from the truth, and they'll be turned aside to fables. Do you think the doctrine of hell and burning forever in hell fire is any more of a fable than Athena with a snake in her temple in Athens? Is it any more of a fable than that? And all of the stories, and all of the make-believe, and all of the inventions of man in their worship of God. The way of Cain is the way of this world. It is the way this world started when man began to sin on the earth. It was reestablished after the flood. It is memorialized by Satan's ideal in Greek mythology. But it comes down, quite frankly, through mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, as a false fable religion as well. It is around us. It's on every side of us. And it's not getting better. And Paul said, remember. Remember to be a light. Hold on to the gospel. Don't accept a different gospel. Be watchful in all things. Endure afflictions. Do the work of an evangelist. Fulfill your ministry, your proper service. God has called us to follow the line that is righteous, and that is the line we must stay.